And hello, I am Daniel Dresner. I am a professor of international politics at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy. I blog at foreignpolicy.com. I am the author of Theories of International Politics and Zombies, and I am ridiculously jet-lagged.
I'm Megan McArdle. I am the business and economics editor of The Atlantic, and I'm a little tired this morning because I was out having a late dinner last night.
Well, I believe
so
you were happy.
We're in good.
But it was for good reason that you were having a late dinner, as I believe.
Yes, indeed it was.
Yeah, so I believe congratulations are in order. It's your first anniversary.
It is my first wedding anniversary. The statute, you know, the warranty has expired. We can no longer trade each other in, and we're stuck. But, you know, overall, I think the preacher did a good job.
Excellent. Were paper gifts exchanged? That's the traditional first anniversary gift.
Well, they would have been, except Peter didn't know about it, and I actually did. I did. He got me a really nice necklace, which I'm now wearing.
Oh, that's very sweet. That really is very
yes.
sweet.
And I got him these font maps of D.C. where each neighborhood is, like, written in the shape of the neighborhood, and it all sort of fits together into a map of the city. I ordered one like a month ago, and it just didn't arrive. And I thought it had, so I went to my office to pick it up on Saturday, and it just wasn't there. So, but there would have been a paper gift.
That is a
yeah. I am a ridiculous sentimentalist.
Well, I think, you know, Peter deserves props for actually going exceeding what the first anniversary should be. So, you know, that's way to go to your husband and
yes.
Yeah.
The traditional thing is interesting, right? Like, it's like an escalating commitment thing.
Right, exactly. Yeah, yeah, no, exactly.
Don't buy anyone. Just in the first year, you don't know where it's going.
So you find this a very economically rational set of traditions that, you know.
Absolutely.
In other words, you don't lock in prematurely. There's also some new version of or I've seen, like, websites where they have, like, a new version of what the modern equivalent of the old ones are, but I can't remember for the life of me what they are.
I feel like those sorts of things are usually designed by Crate and Barrel to maximize their sales.
Well, we should start. So
yes,
we'll start with China because I just got back from there. It was my first visit. I was in Beijing for a whole whopping 4 days for a conference.
Do you have lung cancer yet?
No, but I take your point, which is the truly shocking thing about being there. Is, you know, and this shows the ways in which I actually think the United States has changed over the last 10 years, is that people smoke everywhere, including indoors. And this was just, it was, you know, I've been in the United States long enough, and the smoking laws have been in place long enough that I was genuinely shocked when I saw smoke everywhere. Not to mention smog, because it's ridiculously polluted near Beijing.
Well, the amazing thing to me was I got there the first day, and I was like, the smog isn't that bad. What's everyone been talking about? And it turned out that I had gotten there the day before they allowed, there was some regulation in Beijing that allowed people to turn on their heaters only on a certain day. Buildings yeah. couldn't turn on. And so the next day, like, watched this wave of smog roll in. And then when we got to Shanghai, they just finished the Shanghai Expo.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently China had dealt with this.
Yeah.
By just refusing to allow anyone to incinerate trash
right.
or otherwise for months. And so when we finally got there, it was I've never seen anything like it. It was literally like zero visibility.
It was burning trash
from
day.
From the
yeah.
pollution.
No, I mean,
everyone was burning 6 months worth of trash.
Right. No, I mean, in Beijing, basically, it's always smoggy except for the days after it either rains or there's a windstorm. So my last day there, it was really glorious because it had rained before. And you could really tell the difference in terms of clarity. But otherwise it's pretty smog filled. But still, I really enjoyed the trip. It was a very lovely, lovely time. My Chinese hosts were ridiculously gracious. And I've now been ruined in terms of food. Because the Chinese food.
I know. It was amazing.
Oh, God. You know, it's going to take me at least 2 weeks to be able to eat a Chinese meal here, which is a problem because it's a staple of my American diet. But, you know, other than that, it was interesting for me. Now, you were there for like a 9 or 10 day trip, right?
I was there for, I think, 10 days yeah. and then like a day of travel on either end.
I mean, for me, it was, you know, more of an intensive conference. The goal was to sort of have American and Chinese perspectives on world order. And I blogged a little bit about this, including the fact that I briefly contracted what I call Friedman's disease while I was there, which was the attempt to try to describe China based solely on my cab ride from the airport to my hotel.
I really liked that post. You know, all cab drivers are in the pay of the AP, right? They're like on staff.
Yes, exactly. No, I figured that. I mean, in some ways, this is a journalistic trope of the cabbie must provide good anecdotes. In my case, you know, the cabbie, I didn't speak Mandarin, and the cabbie didn't speak English, but his just general behavior, you know, I've seen enough New York cabbies in movies that this guy fit that bill. I'm not sure he fit the bill in terms of New York cabbies in real life, but like he had this like just, you know, demeanor about him, and he nearly went batshit crazy on this woman who cut him off at one point on the
road. I've seen that in New York. Not all of them, but I remember one of my coworkers coming in literally just drenched from head to toe with coffee because his cab driver had been screaming at someone and then had picked up his cup of coffee and thrown it and not realized the window was closed and so the thing had exploded.
That's pretty
so
good.
So it does happen in New York too. It's not just in the movies. Yeah. Anyway, I'm sorry. Go on.
No, that's fair. But, you know, I mean, in terms of the sort of, you know, I was only there for 4 days and I will not even attempt to draw a generalized lesson. The only thing I thought was the one thing which I just posted about this morning was I did hear the China's director of foreign policy planning, you know, give a talk. And in some ways what he said was essentially, you know, talking to the old China hands around the room, was essentially boilerplate in that there wasn't anything new that he said. But for someone who's not necessarily even used to hearing the boilerplate, that in and of itself was interesting. I think the most interesting thing, the sort of takeaway points I had was first, the extent to which China has really now perfected the art of what I call, Tina Fey invented the term backdoor bragging, which is ways to talk, you know, really nicely about yourself and you sort of insert them casually into the conversation. I think the example on the 30 Rock show was that, you know, it's very tough. Jenna Maroney says, I can't follow American Idol because I have perfect pitch, so I can't really listen to the people singing. So, you know, China talks about how it's ridiculously humble and modest and it learns so well from other countries, things like that. But I think the most genuine thing that he said was this notion that the idea that there's any kind of Beijing consensus in terms of a model for economic development is, bluntly put, horseshit. That, you know, while Chinese are extremely proud of their economic growth over the last couple of years, they in no way think that their model can be replicated anywhere else, and they're pretty pessimistic that they even themselves have a single unified model.
Although, I mean, that's like an interesting sort of, it is an interesting sort of bragging, right? It's like, really, you know what the Chinese model is? It's being awesome.
That is essentially their response. I mean, that you know, our Chinese model is we just grow the living hell out of everything, you know?
Yeah, and like I heard a lot of that while I was there. Like there's this sort of subtle embedded nationalism. What was interesting was the power that it had, that meeting with officials had to turn people like me and other journalists who aren't really very nationalistic people. Like, at one point, we were sitting there with a defense guy who is haranguing us about the dual-use technology export ban.
Yeah.
And the example he chose was that they had these Black Hawk helicopters that they bought before this was in place, and then when there was a flood, they couldn't use them because they couldn't get the parts. And, like, you know, there's a lot of very liberal people on this trip. Yep. There's me and another basically libertarian person, and I really hate export bans and so forth.
Yep.
And, like, we're all looking at each other going, okay, at the end, so who wants to send Black Hawk helicopters to China? And the answer was no one, right? And so I discovered, you know, like, I started defending U.S. policies. You know, in the U.S., I'm the person who's always, like, well, you know, you have to look at this from the perspective of the Chinese, and trade bans don't work, and right. All, you know, on and on and on. And the more that they would harangue us, the more I would say, well, right, but the U.S. has, you know, for sort of ignoring the rest of the world and their interests, the more I would say, well, right, but we also have interests, and we're allowed to. It's not just that, like, you know, I'm fully on board with the notion that the United States may not be as sensitive as it should be to other people's concerns and so forth.
Right.
But the argument that China was making seemed to be that, like, they didn't need to be sensitive to our concerns, but we had damn well better be
sensitive to theirs.
Yeah. Which was
no, I mean,
did you find that as well, or was that just?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think the thing that I found most interesting was the one country this guy went off on was Norway. It is very clear that Nobel Peace Prize rankled a lot. So he was talking, you know, about how at one point that, you know, China has to learn from many, many countries, and you know, other countries have many examples, but that certainly Norway was completely out of place in advising how China should live its life. As he said, you know, Norway has less than 1% of the Chinese population, but over 100 times the resources, and you know, it was just, he went out of his way. It was a completely artificial segue to bash Norway. So I have to assume that, you know, one of the things now that, you know, if you're a Chinese policymaker, you get to do every once in a while is, you know, insert bash Norway paragraph here. And it was just striking the fact that he did it because it was entirely unnecessary. And you know, besides that, yeah, I mean, you know, and some of the Chinese talking points are pretty good, you know, in terms of talking about how the rest of the world is expecting too much of China, but China has made great contributions to, you know, global order in the sense of, you know, contributing to UN peacekeeping and, you know, anti-piracy and anti-terrorism. And, you know, in some ways, even the backdoor bragging thing, God knows U.S. diplomats are guilty of this as well. So it's not like this is unique to the Chinese. In some ways, you sort of have to, I think, put it in context with the problem is that the Chinese have to be more careful than they used to be on this stuff because the rest of the region is now mildly freaked out by them. You know, and, you know, wants to see the ways in which China can provide security assurances and things like that. And I think one of the more telling things that happened last week, for example, was that the Chinese defense minister went to the Shangri-La dialogue, which was in Singapore. And it was a big deal that the defense minister went. Bob Gates was there as well. And he tried to sort of say constantly, you know, we don't have any aggressive intent in the region, and then in the Q&A got, you know, just flustered very, very badly by the press questions of, oh, if you don't have any aggressive intentions, why are you acting like this in the South China Sea, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And you could argue on the one hand that didn't look good for China because the rest of the region wasn't convinced, but in another sense, the very fact that they sent him in the first place might be a useful signal that they recognize they need to engage with the rest of the region. So, I mean, that, you know, the other thing that I'm really happy about, of course, having been to China now, is that for at least the next week I can talk like a management consultant and say, well, you know, when I was in Beijing last week, and then string together a sole group of anecdotes to say that this is completely telling of China. Last year I went to a McKinsey conference, and this literally, like, every consultant seemed to do this. Like, well, you know, when I was in insert obscure Chinese city name here, we saw this, and this tells us about the rest of the world.
So what is it, so having come away from it, I'll ask you the question that an economist of my acquaintance came away. I mean, you obviously weren't there for very long, but what do you think? How much longer can the Chinese boom last?
You know, I don't know because, I mean, if you take a look at I'm really of two minds about this. I mean, on the one hand, I really do think they are due for a course correction, for lack of a better way of putting it. I mean, real estate prices there are just way out of whack. There's a major real estate bubble going on in a lot.
And have just started to fall. The Wall Street Journal reported this week.
Yeah.
Last week.
They've got major, you know, they have major inflation problems. And then there's this sort of Barry Eichengreen analysis that says structurally China has gotten to the point in terms of its GDP per capita where you should expect a slowdown. It can't continue to grow at the rate that it's growing. So, you know, all of these and not to mention the fact that, you know, the reason they were growing at the rate they were for the last couple of years was this sort of major doubling down in terms of investment and infrastructure, which is great, except it's going to lead to overcapacity in parts of the economy where, frankly, they don't need to produce anymore. So,
Not just that, but things like this massive high-speed rail push that was all the rage when I was there and a bunch of people. I got into a really, really, really long Twitter argument. Because I was jet lag, you know the jet lag is terrible when you go to China, and especially for me because I'm just prone to jet lag. Mm-hmm. So I would be up at odd hours and like desperately wanting to sleep at odd hours. And I got into this really long Twitter debate with Steve Waldman, I think of Interfluidity, over whether it was somehow an indictment of the U.S. that we couldn't do China's high-speed rail. And as a matter of fact, it's turned out that it was this giant boondoggle.
Yeah.
There's big problems with the safety. They're having to slow down the trains. They're having to not run some of the trains. People aren't riding it because it's too expensive. And the people who it was intended to like free up their freight rail system by moving people onto the high-speed rail system on completely different tracks, but no one's willing to pay to get on the trains. And so, like, it's lovely. It's very smooth. It's much nicer than U.S. rail. And the Chinese people on our trip were making fun of U.S. Rail, in fact, like, which is...
Well, let's face it, frankly, the entire world should make fun of U.S. Rail. I have no problem with that whatsoever.
Yes and no. Like, the reason that it's hard for the U.S. to build high-speed rail is that we have a lot of valuable real estate.
Oh, high-speed rail. I'm sorry. I thought you said U.S. rail. High-speed rail, that's fine.
No, he was making fun of the Acela. He was like, it's not fast and it's bumpy. And it's like, yes, but upgrading U.S. tracks is really, really complicated because, like, we don't have... either the legal fiat, which I think is a good thing in general, or to put stuff there. And also, like, there's a lot of valuable real estate there.
Right,
and so it's a lot harder to just rip stuff up than it is when there's a bunch of peasants and you can move them to equally or better to an equal or better situation for very little money. And, like, also China, there's a lot of eminent domain abuse and, you know, there have been a lot of complaints about how they handle it. So in general, like, I was defending this, but now it just turns out, like, the guy, the rail minister who we heard talk in this hilarious, like, unique to China thing where you go, not, I think probably in other, like, Asian communist countries it's common as well, but you go and they literally just, like, read you lists of statistics for an hour.
Yes, they
can
do,
go
yeah,
on for
yeah.
longer than that.
Oh, that must
and
have
then,
been fun.
And then they're like, we'll have 10 minutes for Q&A, and that's it. So he's just sat there. I mean, stuff that he could have handed out easily, he'll just read it. And that will be the end of his remarks. It's just, you know, how much rail they've laid, et cetera, et cetera. And so we went through this, and it turns out this guy has embezzled something like $1 squillion from the system, which is one of the reasons that I had cost overruns and, like, the...
Yeah.
And my take is that a couple of things. Its banking system is totally inadequate to a modern economy.
Actually
kind of terrifies me.
Well, the other thing is that the banking sector is one of the major tools through which the Chinese government can try to, you know, prime the pump. And so...
Right.
And in fact, you know, control the economy. So the notion they're going to liberalize that anytime soon is a chimera, I guess, would be the way to put it. I mean, to finish the thought, there are a lot of reasons why I think China's due for a course correction. That said... I don't think that's necessarily going to really slow down China's inevitable rise, because the other fact is China is a continent-wide economy, and there's still lots of room there for sort of intensive development, in a way that could lead to growth, even though it might be inefficient growth, I guess would be the way to put it. Much in the same way that the U.S., I think, developed, you know, in the late 1800s, early 1900s. So, you know, China is a reality as an economic great power. That's not going away anytime soon. That said, I do think there's going to be a bubble that's going to pop and is going to slow them down for a couple of years.
And I wonder what happens when that happens. Because they're really not – I mean, the sense I really got when I was in China, which I guess you sort of already should have known, it's not a blinding insight, but it really drives home the fact that there is – for most Chinese citizens, I think, although we didn't talk to a lot of them, and the people, you know, the people we were most sort of intimate with were members of the Communist Party, but I do get the sense that realistically, like, the Chinese government has cut a kind of grand bargain with its citizens, which is that we're going to be anti-democratic and we're going to restrict your life in annoying ways, but we're also going to deliver 8-10% growth every year.
Well,
That's a deal that people have been willing to take. What happens if they don't deliver the 8-10% growth?
Well, I think you're starting to see what they're going to do, which is, you know, China has doubled down on its coercive apparatus over the last 6 months. I mean, you can argue this is part of a longer trend, but, you know, particularly the Arab Spring has, I think it is safe to say, spooked the Chinese like you wouldn't believe. You know, and they're dealing with, there are ethnic riots breaking out, for example, in Inner Mongolia over the last 2 weeks. I have no doubt that the Chinese coercive state, I mean, Frank Fukuyama makes a great point here, which is to say that, democracy on the whole has many, many advantages over authoritarianism, but the Chinese version of authoritarianism is far superior, for example, to let's say the Arab form of authoritarianism, and it's superior in all aspects of the state, including repressive coercion. So I think the Chinese state can hang on even if there is lower rates of growth. It's just going to look much, much more, brutal, I guess, in that respect. I don't think the Chinese state is going anywhere, I guess, or this version of the Chinese state is going anywhere would be the way.
Well, I think the question you have to ask, though, is at what point does the crackdown and the coercion start to itself interfere with the economic growth that they need to deliver in order to keep the social pact? Because, you know, they're...
I think that's...
In Inner Mongolia, I don't want to say it doesn't matter, obviously.
Yeah,
it matters
a
great deal to the Inner Mongolians, but there's no real modern economy there. It's still basically you know, agrarian subsistence.
I think for that to happen, it would have to be a situation where the unrest would affect, for lack of a better way of putting it, the global supply chain. You know, I mean, the interesting thing about the way, you know, things are working in China is that, you know, they're an integral part of the global production chain. And it's if that production chain gets disrupted that you're going to start to see, you know, foreign investors react, you know, in a different way, and which could, you know, then lead to a negative feedback. I don't know if unrest would ever affect those kinds of places, because if particularly if growth, you know, slows down, it's going to be the people that have jobs that are, you know, that at those places that are going to be the ones that probably won't protest because they're just happy they have jobs. But that said, you're right. If we've learned nothing from the last 6 months, it's learned do not predict what will happen in repressive regimes if there are protests. So, you know, there are ways in which the Chinese system could falter. But that said, if I had to put a bet down, I would bet that the Chinese system will handle things, you know, let's say as well as the Saudi one has, relatively speaking, to the rest of the Middle East. I think the Chinese one can handle a larger amount of unrest than they're coping with now and still manage not to disrupt the global economy.
But in a way, I can make the argument that the Saudi regime handles this the same way the Chinese have, right?
Yeah.
They have certainly kept a lid on their own social problems way better than... I mean, they've been more successful autocrats, as you say, than
right.
any other regime in the Middle East.
Yeah.
But the reason you might argue that they have been able to do that is that they have Aramco, and they are handing out, what is it now?
Oh, they have wads of... I mean, $120 billion. Yeah, yeah. No, they have...
It's not a ton of money, but it's like $5,000 a year.
Yeah.
They
it was salary increases. They increased social spending. You know, I mean, they had the cash on hand to buy off dissent rather than repress it, which is like... I mean, the Chinese complication on this is that... you know, China's sitting on a lot larger set of currency reserves. The problem is that they're dangerous for them if they try to translate the dollars into domestic spending.
Right.
It leads to greater inflation. But that said, you know, China can do this, you know, reasonably well also.
There's also the danger that they tank the dollar and then their dollars aren't worth anything anymore. But
well, okay, this actually is a nice segue, though, because, you know, the concerns are, well, you know, one of the questions that came up was about, you know, attitudes about U.S. debt. You know, the director of policy planning had some fun tweaking, you know, the fact that the U.S. couldn't seem to decide on increasing the debt ceiling and that it would be nice if that was addressed, and particularly the long-term U.S. fiscal picture, which, you know, gives rise to a post that I wrote last week. And you watch the financial markets a little more closely than I do. And this is something that I do not understand because... You know, for a long period of time when the Obama administration sort of engaged in the massive Keynesian stimulus, you know, there were a lot of conservatives who said this will lead to inflation and skyrocketing interest rates because we're borrowing so much. And, you know, Keynesian advocates could legitimately point to the way markets responded by saying, yes, this is why interest rate yields are so low and why the, you know, the dollar is, relatively speaking, kept its value, hasn't plummeted that much. And I thought that was a fair, you know, riposte to that. Well, now we've got a lot of people claiming that if we don't have an agreement on the debt ceiling, you know, there will be, you know, massive devastation. You know, financial markets will panic. Dogs and cats will live together, et cetera, et cetera. And yet, at least so far, financial markets have not priced in any kind of risk, it appears, from a failure to make an agreement on the debt ceiling, despite the fact that Moody's has been warning that you know, this is not likely to happen. Markets haven't freaked out yet, and I don't understand why.
So as the guy leading the charge, making fun of what he calls the invisible bond vigilantes, has, of course, been New York mm-hmm. Times columnist Paul Krugman, mm-hmm. Who has been pointing out that interest rates are incredibly low,
right,
and that this signals that the market is just not worried about our level of debt.
Right.
As Tyler Cowen has pointed out, he is completely inconsistent on this because he's also been banging the drum about like the disaster that is going to follow if the debt ceiling.
Right, exactly, and this is what I don't.
My own take on this is that the markets are quasi-rational. with the markets, it's not that you know.
Could you say that in the Dr. Evil voice? They're quasi-rational.
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 but the my take is this. The markets think we're going to get it together. They just don't believe that. What they believe is either that we're going to raise the debt ceiling or that we're going to prioritize, we're going to cut stuff before we default on our bond obligations, which is all they care about. They do not care. Like, the number of people who have been trying to argue that bondholders care if we default to Social Security recipients, they don't. They don't care. at all, mm-hmm. like, except insofar as they think that that may trigger some political crisis that will eventually lead to default. But they do not, you know, per se care whether we cut through security checks or not. And I don't think that's actually unreasonable. I mean, I think if I were Obama, what I would do if the Republicans refused to raise the debt ceiling is I would say, okay, not mailing any Social Security checks next month, and then wait for the GOP to fall all over themselves to cave. Mm-hmm. Because there's no way, or I would say, I'm sorry, we're not paying military salaries.
Yeah.
We just don't have the money, right? I would pay something. This is like classic budget gimmicks. You may have noticed that every time it happens in companies, happens in local government, mm-hmm. every time they cut the budget, suddenly arts funding and like gym get cut. They don't cut, say, one librarian, et cetera. They cut the most visible sort of heart-rending thing that they can. In order to force people to roll back the budget cuts.
Uh-huh.
And so that's what I would do if I were Obama. I mean, the problem is it could backfire, right? Like,
yeah.
You could be the guy who gets the blame.
Politically, isn't this the big, like, it is literally the $64 trillion gamble, which is which side gets blamed if, in fact, there is a failure to agree? And what the one thing that bothers me is that it really seems that both sides seem to think that the other guy is going to get blamed.
Yes, both sides. My whole, like, I have a large extended metaphor about what's going on with the budget right now, mm-hmm. which is that both sides know that there is a big reckoning coming and that something's going to have to be done.
Yeah.
So all they're doing, but they don't want to be the guy to do it. So all they're doing now is they're strategically trying to strategically position their programs mm-hmm. so that when the crisis hits, rather than doing something about it early, which is the sensible, normal thing to do before you end up in some sort of desperate crisis. Right, it's much less costly to do it if you do it early. But they don't want to do it early. It's painful, your voters yeah. won't like it, et cetera. So all they're doing is positioning themselves for the crisis, positioning their programs for the crisis. What they're trying to do is make it so that the other side has to bear as much of the burden as possible.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem with that, so right, you pass a big new healthcare entitlement, which means that it's going to be harder to cut spending and you're going to have to do more with taxes, et cetera.
Yeah.
The problem with this, I liken it to like in the game of chicken, the classic game theorist advice is the way that you win a game of chicken is that you rip the steering wheel off and you throw it out the window.
Right.
Because then the other guy knows that you can't turn.
Yes, except if...
It does not, however, tell you what to do when the other guy has read the same book, and as you are throwing the steering wheel out the window, you look up to see that the other guy has just tossed his out.
Yes, the problem
which is I think,
is that
the position that we're in.
Simultaneously throwing out the steering wheels, it does lead to the worst outcome, at least to a pretty bad outcome. So
I think that's what we're doing.
Yeah.
But why aren't the markets? Because I think that they think that ultimately, because we have in the past, ultimately we have gotten it together at the last minute and done something. And I think that they're not completely wrong about this, but I do think that what both sides really don't understand is that if they let this happen,
mm-hmm.
it will be worse for them immediately, right? Because if we suddenly can't borrow money,
yeah,
which is what would happen if we didn't pay, you know, if we defaulted on anything for more than a day or two.
Well,
we have defaulted in the past when the computers broke.
Right. I mean, there is another argument out there which says that it actually doesn't matter as much as people think it does, because even though we won't be on, you know, in other words, so long as this is settled a couple of days afterwards, you know, it won't be that big of a deal. And furthermore, in some ways, our biggest creditors still need to buy up American dollars, not because they want to earn interest, but because they're trying to keep their own currencies, you know, relatively in control. So, for example, the argument, you know, I mean, I've heard this argument made that the Chinese are going to still continue to buy, you know, scrip or whatever else, you know, is being issued instead of debt, because their concern is not so much the rate of return. Their concern is the yuan appreciating in value. I
don't know. Look, the Chinese do have to buy American dollars,
yeah.
although they're actually slowing down a lot
yeah.
on their dollar purchases already.
That's interesting.
So, but second of all, like, yeah, they do have to buy American dollars. They do not have to buy American treasury bonds.
That's
there are
right,
other
yeah.
things they can put that money in.
Yeah,
and
no, that's
so
a good point.
I find that, like, maybe, right, if we default for 2 days, the Chinese aren't going to care.
Yeah, yeah.
If it's really, like, a technical thing.
Right.
But I think markets will care. They will discount it, because what it will show people is that there's no sheriff in town.
See, my concern
is that, like,
yeah.
the political process has become so dysfunctional that the American government is willing to default for, like, functionally no reason.
I mean, my concern is that the paradox of this is that I actually think both sides want markets to freak. In other words, the markets freaking out would actually give them somewhat greater political cover to make a deal, to be able to say, look, you know, if we don't do this, markets will melt down. You know, think about what happened the first time TARP failed in the House. You know, the Dow Jones dropped 800
right.
points that day. That was enough to propel finally TARP to get passed, even though it was, you know, it's still ridiculously unpopular. At least in the heat of the moment, it got through. In some ways, it's almost like both sides want that to happen, except, of course, that's really bad if that happens.
And in this case, what it means is that the bond market would be freaking out, and freaking out means that they drive your interest rates up.
Right, exactly.
So what that would mean is that to close the gap, suddenly, you know, if we do something now that's reasonable, slow, et cetera, like, you know, it takes a while to phase in, the markets are fine with it, mm-hmm. et cetera. But if you have to do something quickly at a point when your interest rates are rising, that means that the tax bite and the spending cuts
have to be
greater than
yeah.
they otherwise would.
Yeah. No, that's the problem, which is by doing this, by waiting for the markets to respond, you're actually creating a permanent hike in the cost of solving the problem. So yeah, I mean,
exactly.
That it's not a significant, it's not an insignificant problem. All right, so moving on from that depressing assessment and hoping that eventually the rational part of the quasi-rationality kicks in, we should talk. There's going to be a GOP debate tonight, I believe. Is that correct?
Yes.
All right. Uh-huh. So this is all the major players are going to be there, except for Sarah Palin, if she runs, which I'm now on the fence if she's going to run it. As I said, I think her primary motivation is spite. So my prediction is if Bachman does well in this debate, she will run. But that's a whole separate thing.
I think that it's crazy that she's got to know the polls saying that, like, she can't possibly win and that, like, other Republicans have, at this point, I think, a pretty decent shot against Obama. And Palin, you know, like, I'm pretty disenchanted with the Obama administration. It's not likely that I would vote for them again. But if Sarah Palin ran, I would go and vote for Obama.
Right, exactly. No, I actually don't think Sarah Palin could win the general election. But
I'm not even sure she could win the nomination at this point. I mean, because it'll be interesting, right? Because you remember the 2004 Democratic primary process.
Yeah, when Howard Dean, everyone thought Howard Dean was going to win, and then he flamed out.
Well, the thing was, what was interesting is that, like, at Iowa, and you looked at, when you polled people about their decision process, my understanding is that what they said is they were trying to pick someone who could win.
Right.
And so the reason Kerry got the nomination was not that anyone liked him. It was a bunch of fairly radical, you know, not radical is not the right word, but you know what I'm talking about. The really hardcore partisan.
The hardcore
party
operatives, yeah.
That those people were all like, he's, you know, a military dude. You Republicans love that crap. We'll totally nominate him. And of course, it backfired in all sorts of ways.
Well, I mean,
because they didn't understand that things like the Winter Soldier
yeah.
stuff were not going to endear him to the military loving. And then they exacerbated the problem with reporting for duty. And
I mean, I guess this leads to two questions. The first is that, you know, Iowa might be a little different for the Republicans than for the Democrats.
Right, no, that's what I was going to ask.
Yeah.
Is actually, like, does that happen for the Republicans, or do they just decide to send a giant screw you to the rest of the American public?
Well, the one thing is that, remember, I mean, Bachman plays particularly strong in Iowa because she's from there. And also, you know, everything I've read suggests that she's actually, you know, really, she's actually been serious about building a ground game there in a way that is the exact opposite, by the way, of Sarah Palin in that sense. So, you know, she might actually come away relatively strong from there. And also, correct me if I'm wrong, I mean, the 2004 example you're talking about is more an anomaly, or it might be more consistent for the Democrats, but think about who in the Republicans have done well in Iowa. You know, it's always I mean, Huckabee won in 2008, correct?
I don't remember.
I think Huckabee won it in 2008. You know, if memory serves, Pat Buchanan did well there.
And yet, who took, you know, who won the primary process? It was John McCain, who, I mean,
right.
for all of my dislike of many of the things I was not a John McCain supporter.
Yeah.
Is, like, basically a centrist, boring kind of guy.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, like, insofar as Obama is centrist, right? Like,
right.
he's a mainstream candidate.
Yeah.
He's definitely, you know, not particularly orthodox, et cetera. And I think that, in fact, Obama is actually much more of an orthodox Democratic candidate than I think McCain was an orthodox Republican candidate. And so, like, you know, we've been hearing a lot about how the Tea Parties are going to just, you know, they're so partisan and they're just going to destroy everything. And yet, the last time we had a presidential election, admittedly before the Tea Party movement became big, but still, these allegedly incredibly rabidly partisan Republicans nominated someone who was basically pretty electable.
I mean, I think in some ways, I think this. This depends on a couple of things. The first is, you know, I mean, it's always, and you know this, it's turnout. I mean, the one thing that you could argue that the Tea Party, you know, movement might have more than any other group is that they all, those people are going to vote in primaries, and so the question becomes, you know, will that push them forward? First of all, will the, in some ways, I think it's almost a race to see which, whether the sort of more mainstream Republicans, Main Street Republicans, develop a consensus about which candidate they're going to back, versus whether the Tea Party develops a consensus approach about which candidate they're going to back. So let's say, for example, that Bachman becomes the consensus Tea Party candidate, but you still have Pawlenty, Romney. I don't know, maybe Huntsman gets in the race, and I can't think of someone else at this point. Gingrich, really, he's just an amusement at this point.
Anthony Weiner of the Republican Party.
Oh, I think that might be the most damning thing said about Newt Gingrich in the last week.
He's just a train wreck, and like you can't stop looking at it, but you don't want to. It's terrible.
In other words, if the establishment is still split, and as a result that leads to, the Tea Party candidate winning more primaries at the outset, that could lead to a trigger effect where they might actually win the nomination. But we don't know. And I think part of this is because also, correct me if I'm wrong, the Republican primary system is much more winner-take-all than the Democrat one.
I don't know. Okay. I confess I'm not enough of a sort of political operative.
This is always the set of knowledge that we remember, every election year and then probably forget the year after that. So, I guess my question is there anything, are you going to watch the debate tonight or is there anything,
I am. I'm going to watch it and blog about it. Honestly, I floated a proposal on Twitter a couple weeks ago that I think, honestly, at this point, I think I might support Obama for president for life if we just don't have to report any more of these primaries, but I don't think that's going to be a position. Yeah, so I'm going to watch it. I'm going to report on all of these things. I've been already, I wrote my first kind of election post the other day where I reported on Tim Pawlenty's. No other way to say it, but insane proposal to make the United States gross domestic product grow at a real rate, which is adjusted for inflation, of 5% a year, as opposed to the 3% that's average and the 2% that we've been having. And now it's not entirely right. Like, we could totally, Tim Pawlenty could get elected president and we could see 5% annual growth for a couple of years. That's entirely plausible. I'm not saying it's the most likely outcome. I have no idea.
Yeah.
That could totally happen. But it wouldn't happen because Tim Pawlenty did anything.
Right.
It would happen
because
we've been growing really slowly, and we would be reverting back. It wouldn't be like his magic, awesome tax cut and deregulation plan.
Yeah.
And
also, you can't have a plan based on the magical assumption of, we are going to grow at a rate that exceeds what the post-war economic growth rate has looked like for the last 60 years.
Well, and not only just for a couple of years, we're going to do that for 10 solid years.
He said we're going to do that for 10 years?
Yes, it was just crazy. And he's like, well, look, it would generate so much tax revenue. And you're like, yes, it would.
It
would also generate a lot of tax revenue if we got the fairies to drop up bags of gold.
So this is basically the Tim Pawlenty free pony plan.
Yeah, no, it's the rainbows and magic ponies plan for the American economy. And, of course, the thing is, like, the problem is, now that I've criticized this, I'm going to have to criticize all of the wackadoodle stuff that Barack Obama is going to claim for his economic policies.
Yeah.
And I'm going to have to spend the next, 2 years as everyone launches these, like, ever more unrealistic. I mean, the thing I really fear is that Tim Pawlenty has set a bar here that now everyone else is going to have to leap over, where, like, they're going to have to come up with some equally crazy and implausible thing that most people won't know is crazy and implausible because most people don't study economics.
Yeah.
And so it's going to be...
The only way I can cheer you up on this is to reassure you that it's not 2 years. It's only, I believe, 18 months.
It's only 18 months. I will hold on to that.
Well, if it makes you feel any better, what I'll, of course, be looking for is I invented a new award for this campaign season called the Trumpy. And this is for what I call assertive ignorance in world politics.
So what did Trump do to generate the first Trumpy?
Donald Trump argued that really the way he could solve the U.S. economy was to send the right negotiator in the room with OPEC to lower oil prices and send the right negotiator in the room to China to get them to appreciate their the renminbi.
Did we not have a good negotiator? Is that our problem?
That was our problem. Apparently, it wasn't that these are structural issues that are, demonstrate the limits of U.S. power. It's in fact that we just haven't put the right guy in the room. I had to award him the Trumpy for that. And, already we've had two others earn this. Herman Cain earned one for not having any clue what the right of return was, in Middle East, and yet asserting... On the Fox News Sunday that should be an issue that should be negotiated between the Palestinians and the Israelis, when in fact there's no way the Israelis want to talk about that. And then Paul Ryan demonstrated that in his first foreign policy speech in terms of assuming that the U.S. Could demand more from its allies in terms of things like defense contributions, which admittedly is something we would like to have. I mean, even Bob Gates has said that. But the notion that somehow that will be the solution to our policy problems is borders on fantasy. So I'll be looking for, the key thing about this to earn a Trumpy is not just to demonstrate ignorance in foreign policy, but to demonstrate that ignorance and yet still cast a demeanor that indicates you actually know what you're talking about.
Right, and to build a policy around
right. So in other words, I have no problem, and let me be clear about this, I really have no problem with candidates saying, I don't know. I actually find that refreshing on foreign affairs, because let's face it, it's a really complex world out there. But a foreign policy that says, I know that this is true when in fact this is not true, and we will build a policy based on that.
What about the candidates who just don't know the name of the president of Turkmenistan? This is like the Republican candidates.
I'm going to cut some slack. It's very interesting. Obviously, it's going to be the GOP side that's going to earn most of the Trumpy nominations until Joe Biden starts campaigning. But the fact, I got a lot of, criticism about this, saying, well, what about when Barack Obama talked about the 58 states and so forth? I'm giving a pass for sort of just people who are tired. Like, Tim Pawlenty gave an answer about Iran, and it was very clear he thought the question was about Iraq. And then he was correct. He's like, no, I'm sorry, I meant Iraq. The answer wasn't that bad as these things go. So, flubs like that and failing to know who the Turkmenistan president is, that's fine. I'm not gonna assume, omniscience on this stuff. It's more pretending that you do know something when in fact you don't. That I think is how you earn it in my book.
Well, I hate to say this, but I think that there are going to be a lot of Trumpies handed out.
I am looking forward. Maybe that'll be my drinking game tonight, to watch this, is to see just who says the absolute stupidest thing.
I hope you're going to blog the results.
Yes, it's going to be. It's not going to be pretty.
And increasingly, ha 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 ha. LOL.
I was saying it's going to be. You and I are going to experience some very drunk Twitter feeds tonight, I suspect.
The only way to get through it.
Exactly. We should close by talking about a sort of internet scandal du jour, and for once, we're not talking about Anthony Weiner, which is there was a scandal per se in that. There was a blog ostensibly based done by a Syrian lesbian that's been up since February, talking about the life of a Syrian lesbian that has now been revealed to be, in fact, the nom de guerre of a guy named Tom McMaster, who is an American getting a master's degree, I believe, in international relations somewhere in Scotland. Because the blog claimed this woman had been arrested, at which point the press started reporting, oh my God, this very famous Syrian blogger was arrested. And then everyone began to notice that they had never actually seen a picture of this person, and the pictures that had been uploaded turned out to be, someone else. And at which point the guy then copped to it, and let me read what he said. I never expected this level of attention. While the narrative voice may have been fictional, the facts on this blog are true and not misleading as to the situation on the ground. I do not believe I have harmed anyone. I feel that I have created an important voice for issues that I feel strongly about. This experience has sadly only confirmed my feelings regarding the often superficial coverage of the Middle East and the pervasiveness of new forms of, I'm not making this up, liberal Orientalism. Therefore, a nice shout out to Edward Said. So, you know, this is just the latest in a long series of things apparently not to do on the internet, which is do not pretend to be a Syrian lesbian.
I don't understand why people do things like this, and yet it's shockingly common. You know, what makes you think, like, what I should do is start a blog in which I pretend to be someone much sort of more unusual than I am? And it's not surprising to me that he arrested her, as it were. That, you know, my understanding of these sorts of things is that when they happen, usually what happens is that the person running the con kills the person off or attempts to, because it gets out of hand, right?
Yeah,
like
yeah.
People want to meet you, people,
right.
And maintaining it takes an enormous amount of effort, and so you attempt to put them out of commission in a way that explains their decision to suddenly go offline.
Well, all right. I would say two things. First, I will defend the occasional use of this tactic. Part of the problem is that not this exactly, but I was thinking I think one of the funniest things I've read in the last year was the fake Rahm Emanuel tweets. Did you read that feed?
Oh, sure, but those weren't. I mean, like those.
Those were obviously fake.
Like
fake,
being
yes.
fake Steve Jobs, etc.
Right.
Like those are hilarious.
Yeah,
but they're
yeah.
also clearly
fake.
But it's the people who are doing it with an intent to deceive, right?
Right.
This guy wanted people to think he was a Syrian lesbian.
Yeah. Which
he wasn't doing it to be. No, no, no. I think the fake impersonations are hilarious.
Okay,
all
right. So let's separating that. I mean, I suspect that what happens frequently is that people don't ever think that these things are ever going to blow up. I wonder if people do this with the notion that they don't really think that they're going to get quite the level of media scrutiny that they wind up getting. That's the only thing I can assume, because otherwise I don't get the motivation either. In the sense of the notion that this guy genuinely thought that, you know, by being exposed, he's just uncovered the superficial Western nature of the coverage of the Middle East. You know, it does border on the delusional because, you know, I don't think he realizes the extent to which he's done damage to the very cause that he's ostensibly trying to promote, which is presumably freedom for, you know, BGLU, you know, or however you want to put that community in Syria and in the Middle East, because God knows they face real issues. I think, unfortunately, it's even more problematic in the Middle East where there are very, very, very good reasons to be anonymous online. I mean, that's the other
right.
complicating factor here, which is, you know, I think there are ways in which there, unfortunately, this is probably more likely to happen in places where you would understand the reason for anonymity than others.
Well, I'm trying to think of, because there have been other examples of this, right? There have been quite a few of there was a alleged sex worker who,
yes.
People started realizing they'd never met her and that she didn't show up and that, like, and ultimately what's interesting is that they always end up, and I'm not sure that the sex worker ever spoke about it, but the people who do things like this so often end up defending it on the grounds
yeah.
that they were somehow either victims of oppression or they were doing it for a good cause.
Or they were doing it for victims of oppression, that even if they
yeah.
weren't themselves, they were trying to highlight the problem involved.
I mean, I think about people like Jason Blair,
yeah,
right,
yeah.
who did enormous damage. First of all, like, you know, for a guy who's so concerned about how badly minorities are treated, like, he basically blew up the New York Times affirmative action program.
Right.
But also, like, it was pathological. It wasn't something he had to do because, you know, Stephen Glass did it too, and he was, like, a privileged white kid from the suburbs. There's not the people who do this are, like, sociopaths. They're not people, the qualities needed to keep abusing the trust of people, because if you think about the interactions he's having with people and he's developing online friendships and he's just abusing their trust.
You know, I don't
right?
I don't know if I would say you know, sociopath, it demonstrates a sociopath. I mean, in some ways here I think Stephen Glass is different from the rest of them. I mean, I think the better way to put it is these people are monomaniacal. In that if they genuinely think there is an issue they care about. They don't, you know, it's sort of the ends justify the means, so they're perfectly happy to subvert the, you know, to lie and do any, you know, sort of other thing online if they feel like they're promoting their cause. Which, of course, the problem, as you say, is that once they get outed, clearly they've much more sabotaged their cause, done much more harm than any possible temporary benefit. I think the problem is that they only see the temporary benefit.
But I have to say that I suspect that they enjoy it.
Oh, yeah, I'm sorry, yes, yes.
I mean, I suspect that they enjoy deceiving people.
Yes.
That they enjoy the attention and the... because almost no one does this, right? It would be very advantageous to do it, and yet few people do.
That's a good point. Okay.
And like, to this extent, I mean, you have always have people concealing their motives, et cetera, but simply just pretending to be... And completely deceiving people. And if you think about establishing an online friendship, because we knew each other, right? Like lots of bloggers, we knew each other online long before we met in person.
Yeah.
And if you think about all of those interactions, which get quite personal and sort of you feel like you really know someone, to keep it up.
Yeah.
Keep up the... I mean, it's a really high degree of deception of someone who's clearly a nice person who's trusting you. And the ability to do that strikes me as... I don't think a propaganda wing of a party or something would be different, but to just do freelance this on your own, I do suspect that they do it in part because they like and people do, right? Like, I used to, when I was in college, we would go into bars and make up ridiculous stories and tell them because it was fun, but it was like basically also harmless. No,
what was
really
your most
care,
ridiculous
right?
bar story?
It wasn't mine. I had my most ridiculous bar story was there was a guy who was hitting on me.
Yeah.
This was after college and I was meeting some colleagues and one of my colleagues was Irish and told this guy, because I was trying to get rid of him, told this guy that I was his cousin, he was like, I was an Irish American. He was from Ireland. I was his cousin. And then he had come over to facilitate my arranged marriage to someone I'd never met and that we were meeting in this bar. And this kid, like, his last name was, like, Kelly or something. I have no idea where he got the idea that arranged marriages were still common in Ireland. But it went on, and he's trying to get me to, like, not go through with it. And he's trying to persuade me, and he's getting drunker. And I was like, no, I really can't. You know, it's the honor of my family. And then his roommate showed up, and, like, he was like, and this is the guy. And, like, completely, I don't know how, picked it up from just that cue.
Wow.
I mean, this was before, like, texting or cell phones.
That's impressive.
So, and was just like, and went through, and I now feel kind of bad about it. I mean, I now look back and I think, well, I was, that was sort of callous. On the other hand, like, people who try to...
Yeah, hold on, I gotta stick up for guys who actually, like, have the courage to, you know, to hit on someone like you. So, you know, how dare you be that mean?
I tried to get him to go away through more subtle means.
Fair enough.
And he was very persistent and would not leave. In my defense.
I don't know. I'm very proud. I never used any sort of deception like that in bars. This is mostly because I actually can honestly say I don't think I ever hit on a woman in a bar.
but I recognize now that it was a terrible thing to do. I'm not going to defend it. It was mean. And, like, we shouldn't have done it. On the other hand, we were drinking, and I was in a large group of people. And what people do, unfortunately, when they're drinking and in a large group of people is not... It's, you know, like... boundaries get broken down, et cetera. But I'm not going to defend this behavior. It was, and to do it, and also we didn't do it for months. I would have felt terrible if I had had this guy going for more than 20 minutes. That would, and if you
no, there was a difference between doing
friends and like that's a level of, again, not defending what I did. Totally, I was a terrible, terrible 21-year-old. I probably should have been shot for my own good. But there's a but lots of people do that. Lots of people do not get online and start. And as I now recall, that sex worker guy was basically using it to, get freebies from prostitutes that he allegedly met as a sex worker.
Oh God.
Like people who said they wanted to become sex workers, they would be like, well, I have a client. He'll start you off. He's a really nice guy, et cetera, et cetera. And it was this guy who was impersonating the sex worker. I'm pretty sure that's how it sort of ended up being resolved. So, I mean, like, terrible. That was really especially abusive. But in general, I think someone who can maintain that for months is enjoying it in some way that's really sad and unhealthy. They're not just doing it for because it's a good cause. And it, as you say, it destroys the cause. I mean, it's sort of like Michael Belial with Arming America.
I always wondered
what he thought. Like, for those who don't know, this guy wrote a book basically arguing that there were virtually no guns in colonial America, and that
right.
the whole myth, the whole idea of American guns as being connected to American freedom was a myth.
And he essentially based this on a lot of sort of probate records and will and auction records, and which all
where he just made it up. I mean, like, and it was kind of extraordinary that he wasn't caught sooner, because, for example, the sort of really devastating table was all these probate records, and the cells in the table did not add up. So if you looked at the totals on the sides and at the bottom, they didn't. The cells in the table did not sum to those totals.
Mm-hmm.
So someone should have asked him to redo it just immediately that way. But he claimed to have accessed probate records that had been destroyed in the 1906 San Francisco fire. He claimed, the people who checked the probate records that did exist turned out to look nothing like what he claimed. And it took years. I mean, literally, the book was published in 96. The first article, which then became a book, was published in 96, and it eventually went down, I think, in 2003.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
For this.
Yeah.
But I've always wondered, I've always thought he must have not just thought that he was doing this for a good cause, or even to get tenure. He must have, at some level, enjoyed putting the deception over on people, because otherwise you would think it's... I mean, you're an academic, and you know what this would do to your career. If nothing else, how risky it is, right?
There's no denying that. I mean, that's something I honestly can't... I can't get into the mindset of why someone would do that.
It must be like... Sorry, for me, like Stephen Glass, I can't even watch Shattered Glass. Because I'm so nervous about getting things wrong by accident, that the idea of doing it on purpose, it makes me so... I assume it's the same for academics contemplating the...
Right, no, it's just something you just sort of shudder and walk away from. You don't ever want to, you don't ever want to think about that. The only kind of thing I can see like that was more like the Doris Kearns Goodwin case where, and that's a little different. It's not that I ever want to do that, but now I can see how that happened, because she's so busy and she relied so much on RAs that, in this world of cut and paste, I can see kind of how that happened. And that's one of those things where, I'm actually kind of glad that thing happened, because it now makes me very, very wary when I'm writing to make sure that I don't do things like that. I can see that happening to people. But that the Michael Bly thing is totally on a different...
I find myself doing it. I'll find myself, not whole passages, but I will find myself accidentally... especially when I'm blogging and I'm doing it quickly, I'll end up inserting a sentence half an hour later that I read, and I think I'm paraphrasing.
Yeah.
But then I look back at the article and I realize I've lifted it. I somehow remembered the whole sentence and have lifted it word for word, and then I have to go back and paraphrase.
Yeah.
And I'm always linking the article and so forth, so it's not quite the same thing, but it is easier to understand than just making stuff up, which is just, to me, incomprehensible. The plagiarists who get caught... The journalists who get caught plagiarizing, it's usually, the difference I think is that it's usually much worse when they get caught plagiarizing.
Mm-hmm.
My understanding of Goodwin and Ambrose and those people was that they would have, in a whole book, they would have a paragraph or two at a time.
Right.
Whereas sometimes you'll see journalists who have plagiarized,
a much larger percentage, that's true.
And that's just, I understand they're under deadline, but... There's just no excuse for that, ever.
Well, on that depressing note, I need to get going. But as always, it was a pleasure, Megan. You tweeted last night that because it was your first anniversary and to your favorite husband. I hope I'm your favorite blogging heads partner. That's the only.
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, thank you.
I mean, I have to say only because I have never blogging heads with my husband.
Right, exactly.
But you would be totally my second favorite blogging heads partner.
Thank you very much. All right, well,
yes.
I will see you on Twitter tonight as we both get more and more drunk.
Oh, well, until then, farewell, Dan, and farewell, Internet.
All right, take care.
Bye.
Bye.